From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Alini Bajus, VOA immigration reporter. Our topic on this edition of the program, the Trump administration's approach to U.S. immigration policy. As a presidential candidate, Donald Trump railed against illegal border crossings from Mexico, even using the phrase, quote, rapists and murderers, to describe those crossing unlawfully and calling for the construction of a border wall. One of his first actions as president was to issue a travel ban on a number of citizens from Muslim-majority countries. That ban was challenged in lower courts, but the U.S. Supreme Court recently upheld a modified version. President Trump's approach to legal and illegal immigration is popular with a number of his supporters. However, a broad cross-section of Americans and immigrants' rights groups who acknowledge that the U.S. immigration system is in need of major reform oppose the Trump administration's particular approach, calling it excessively punitive. Most recently, the Trump administration issued a so-called zero-tolerance policy to deter migrants fleeing violence from Central America who attempted to apply for asylum. This resulted in the separation of children, including minors, from their parents. However, an outcry from a cross-section of ordinary Americans, including former Republican First Lady Laura Bush, scaled back this policy. To analyze the Trump administration's approach to legal as well as illegal immigration policy, we welcome our special guest, Doris Meissner. She's former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, now a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the Institute's U.S. immigration policy work. Ms. Meissner previously served in the Bill Clinton administration as commissioner of the INS, then a bureau in the U.S. Department of Justice. And Doris Meissner joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome for the first time, but hopefully not the last on the show, Alini Bajus.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Doris Meissner, let's get first your take on the Trump administration's policy as you understand it, in a sense toward both legal and illegal immigration, because some analysts are saying that underlying Mr. Trump's approach is, in a sense, a sort of a disdain for all immigrants, which some analysts say flies in the face of our foundational principle as a country, which was built upon the backs of immigrants.
Well, the Trump administration certainly does represent a very different approach and basic set of views about immigration. It's interesting, even though we've had strong policy disagreements between the Republican and the Democratic parties over the years on how immigration should actually be handled, what specific policies should be, for instance, at the border or towards asylum seekers. Nonetheless, there's been a broad consensus shared by Republicans and Democrats that overall, immigration is a net positive for our country. It's part of our history. It belongs part of our future. That is not the view that President Trump has carried or has brought into office. His view and his characterization of immigration is that immigration represents a threat to the country, that it represents a threat to national security and a threat to American workers and jobs. And so he has staked a presidential election and a candidacy on that, along with several other topics, such as trade, that have to do with globalism and international issues. But immigration was a real driving element of his campaign for the presidency. That has not happened before. That has not happened in the modern era of American politics. And most people did not believe that that could be a winning strategy. But in fact, as we know, of course, it was. And the other thing that goes with that is that this is a president who has been deeply committed to keeping his promises. And on immigration, that is coming to pass. The promises made in the campaign have been the governing playbook for the administration on immigration issues. As a result, we've seen the things that you've talked about, the travel ban, reductions in refugee resettlement, all things that he talked about during the campaign. So what we're seeing is those promises kept, but those are promises that are at strong contradiction or disagreement from what our history has been on immigration.
What our history and some of the positions fly in the face of some facts, and we'll get into that in a moment. Let me turn to my colleague Eleni Bajos for a follow-up.
I've been following immigration for the past, I would say, 2 years now. And I asked different people, what do you think is broken? So now I want to ask you, what would you say is broken? Because we hear over and over, our immigration system is broken. But what is it broken exactly?
The broken system has become an absolute terminology, you're right, that is used all the time. So to try to capsulize what's broken about the system, let me say two or three things. I think the thing that is the most evident about what's broken in the system is that we have a population of about 11 million foreign-born who have come to the United States who do not have a legal status in the United States. We have an overall foreign-born population of about 45 million in the country. So about one in four, roughly, foreign-born in the United States doesn't have a legal status. That is really an indefensible situation for a country that is a nation of immigrants, but a country that is also a nation of laws. And that is broadly the brokenness of the system. Now, why is that the case? That is the case because our laws have not been updated in a way that aligns with the economic reality of what is going on in our country, in our labor market, in our growth, and in our productivity. We are, for the first time, an aging nation. So we do not give birth out of the native-born population to enough younger workers to keep this booming economy going. And we have tapped into the remaining unused labor market resources. The big, large group that came into the labor market in the 70s, 80s, and 90s were women. That's basically reached its level. And so that picture is one where, especially in the 1990s, when we went through a period of unprecedented job growth, immigration filled the gap. But the laws did not catch up with that change. And so much of that immigration, therefore, became illegal immigration.
So Doris Meissner, this inability to deal with our immigration system precedes Mr. Trump and his more extreme policy. Why is it that previous administrations have not been able to come to terms with reforming the immigration system, the legal immigration system, and dealing with this undocumented population?
It is certainly the case that this issue has been around for a while, and the fact that it hasn't been tended to, and the inability of our political system to respond in any meaningful way, really contributed to the kinds of resentment and the kinds of anger that helped this election succeed. So they are very closely tied together. It's a real breakdown in our political system that applies not only to immigration, but to lots of larger issues that we've not been able to deal with. It has to do with the way that our congressional districts are allocated. The term is gerrymandering. It has to do with the way our politics and campaigns are financed, very much in the hands of small numbers of donors. It has to do with the real divisions that have been intensified in our country between rural areas and urban areas, between people who are the beneficiaries of services that are provided by foreign-born workers but that are not shared generally around the country. So we're experiencing in immigration in particular the dysfunctions of our politics more generally, but they're particularly acute for immigration, because we've never historically been able to update our immigration laws very frequently under even better circumstances. Immigration tends to be one of those subjects that is very difficult politically because both parties have disagreements inside of their parties on what immigration should look like.
So following up on that, we see that immigration and economy walk alongside. So merit-based and family immigration reunification, what is the outcome economically for the two systems? What would work better for the U.S.?
Well, our immigration system is basically made up of four or five streams. First is family-based immigration, as you say. Family-based immigration is the most important and the largest share of our immigration, and that's based on our history, and it's also based on the very practical fact that as a country that welcomes people but doesn't support people once they get here, the support structure for helping immigrants to succeed has been family and family networks over the course of our history. So that's actually worked very well for us. The second stream of immigration is meeting labor market needs, labor market-based immigration, but it's a much smaller proportion of our legal immigration. Our family immigration is about two-thirds. Our employment-based immigration is about 16%. So it's quite a difference. Our third immigration stream is humanitarian immigration, and that has to do with refugee admissions and refugee resettlement. And then finally, a more recent stream of immigration, which was established in 1990, is known as diversity-based immigration. And that diversity-based immigration is for the purposes of maintaining some access and some diversity so that our immigration is not simply from a few parts of the world. So diversity has been an important newer feature of immigration in order to maintain the universality. And the United States has prided itself on being a country that is open to immigrants from around the world. And many have dubbed us the first universal nation as a result.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Doris Meissner. She's former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, now senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. That's a Washington-based nonpartisan organization devoted to analyzing immigration policy. And joining me on the program is VOA immigration reporter Alini Bajos. And I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find it on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And please follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a big shout out to a Facebook fan, Saman Jalinus from Iran. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to our special guest, Doris Meissner. And Doris, I would like to follow up on your discussion about our various immigration streams. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but if I understand it correctly, Mr. Trump would like to lessen what we call family migration, which was established from the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act, and he would like to boost what you call the labor market-based visas or economic-based visas. What is your view of that approach, and how viable is it?
Well, I think it's fair to say that what the president is calling for is pretty dramatic reductions in all forms of immigration. He's been particularly focused on reducing refugee admissions, and he's been particularly critical of family-based immigration. But overall, he is looking for a country that has significantly reduced immigration of all streams. However, what we know in terms of employment-based immigration is, yes, we do need to have more employment-based immigration that is legal immigration. That is the part of the answer to the brokenness of the system, is that there's been an economic demand and there have been needs for employment-based immigration, but there is not the possibility under our current immigration laws of coming anywhere close to meeting those needs. And so that's become, in many ways, illegal immigration. So I think there's general broad agreement that employment-based immigration needs to increase. It needs to be done more effectively in terms of meeting employer needs, but at the same time, in ways that are not harmful to American workers, that don't don't concede certain large areas of the labor market to foreign-born labor. And those are issues that have to be addressed in legislation. There have been many proposals over the years, but as we've said, no real ability to get the political consensus to enact them. However, this does not need to be an either-or thing in terms of family immigration, employment-based immigration, humanitarian immigration. These can be reconciled. And so the attacks that we've seen and the attacks that are particularly associated with President Trump are really hurting the ability of legislators to try to come to some agreement on something that is, by definition, a controversial topic and always has been in our legislative history.
Following up on that, during the whole family separation issue going on, I was in Texas. I was in McAllen in Brownsville, and I got to see the border and the wall and speak with residents on those towns. And the whole time I'm looking, where is the crisis? What is going on? So I want to ask you, based on your research, is there a border crisis?
No, there is not a border crisis. I mean, this narrative that has been developed, particularly by this administration, that we are being invaded and that we are being taken advantage of, is not borne out by the numbers. The high peak of illegal immigration across the southwest border came in the year 2000. And during that year, we had 1.6 million apprehensions. Now, mind you, an apprehension is not a person. The numbers are kept in terms of enforcement actions, but they are the best approximation that we have to the level of flows across the border. 2000, 1.6 million. We're now down to somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 to 400,000 a year. That is a dramatic reduction from the high peak of illegal immigration across the southwest border. For a country as large as we, for a country that has a southwest border that until quite recently separated countries of the most stark difference in living standards and in wages, that is changing now because Mexico is really developing in effective ways. But those kinds of numbers are manageable numbers. They're manageable numbers to a great extent because of the investments that the United States has made in border enforcement in the last 15 to 25 years, particularly since 9/11. We as a country have invested billions of dollars in southwest border enforcement. In fact, a number that is so important to point out is that we now as a country have more money allocated to immigration enforcement than we allocate for federal criminal law enforcement of the FBI, the DEA, the Secret Service, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. In other words, we're spending about a quarter more on immigration enforcement than all of our other federal criminal law enforcement responsibilities. And that enforcement matters. It's made a difference. It's made a difference in combination with a recession that really reduced significantly the labor market demand for immigrants to come unlawfully to the United States. And it's combined with real changes in Mexico so that there are not the same kinds of push factors from Mexico that have generated most of the illegal immigration over the last 30 to 40 years. What has changed is the composition of the crossings at the southwest border and the countries from which people come. Mexico is no longer the primary source of illegal immigration across the southwest border. Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador is. And those are people who are coming seeking protection and looking for asylum in the United States, not people coming primarily for jobs.
It's interesting that you said that because while I was there, one of the questions that I had to everybody was, so are you going to apply for asylum? And the face was, what do you mean asylum? People didn't understand the meaning of the word asylum. Basically, what they wanted was, look, I didn't have milk. My kids are starving. This was the way that I found that, you know, I could survive with my family. Most of them were mothers and little kids. So if you could explain the current asylum situation that we have right now, what I saw was literally family units, mostly women and children running away from civil war, from those the three countries that you mentioned. most of them, and those are based on my interviews, do not know what asylum is. Can you tell us what's the current situation of asylum in the U.S.?
And let me add also, these people, mostly women and children fleeing from the depredations and violence in Central America, this is a bad thing. And to what extent do you know if the United States is addressing the root problem in order to help prevent them from coming here? But once they are here, as Alini said, seeking asylum, we have laws that govern that. Have they been respected by the Trump administration? Have there been some other alterations? Or how do you see this whole so-called crisis that we have witnessed recently with the family separations?
Well, the shift in the flows across the southwest border have been gradually developing over the last 4 or 5 years. So this is not a new issue for this administration. There was a real peak in 2014 during the prior administration, the Obama administration, the numbers of unaccompanied children, those are migrants under the age of 18 who are not with parents, peaked. That, again, was not a new phenomenon. We've always had several thousand young people coming on their own to the United States. It was a pretty steady state number. But it is now also being superseded by the families that you're describing, those being generally mothers, sometimes fathers, with younger children, children that are under the age of 12, 10. This, of course, is, as you say, because of deteriorating conditions, increasing violence in and gang recruitment in particular in the three Central American countries that we've talked about. It's also because there are very strong and established communities in the United States of migrants who formerly came from those countries. And so there's a connection here and a place that people know and think they might be able to come and get help. This is a very difficult problem for the United States. The last administration struggled with it. We struggled with it when I was in government in the 1990s, because at that time we were dealing with the aftermath of the civil wars of the 1980s that first triggered migration from the Central American countries to the United States, and it's continued since because these networks of relationships have formed. The best answer that we have to it is the asylum system. It's an inadequate answer, because the asylum system is based on the international refugee definition, which is that one must make a showing of persecution or the likelihood of persecution on the basis of race, religion, ethnicity, political opinion, or membership in a social group. And that definition is really an outgrowth of the experiences of the Second World War, where states and governments persecuted people. The kind of violence and the kind of harm that we're seeing today in the countries of Central America and other parts of the world are not persecution brought about by governments. They're persecution-like circumstances that are carried forward by non-state actors. That's the terminology. The international law, U.S. law, to some extent, has attempted to adapt and evolve in relation to these changing circumstances, but it's by no means a real fit. So the only good answer that we have in the face of these current flows that you saw and that we're experiencing is a case-by-case review of people's stories. And that case-by-case review can be done in our asylum system, which involves either immigration judges or it involves asylum officers. We have not staffed up and resourced those functions in the way that we have resourced border enforcement through the Border Patrol and through detention and deportation. My argument would be the way in which we're doing border enforcement today needs to shift and needs to take into account and incorporate far more attention to and resources for these asylum decision-making mechanisms so that we can deal with the change in the flows. Those decisions need to be made in a timely fashion. They need to be in a fair fashion. But not all of those people will by any means qualify for asylum. But the answer ultimately must go, as you've suggested, to the conditions in those countries. These are countries that are nearby. They are our neighbors. They are our allies. They need to have stronger governance. They need to have real police and law enforcement presence. There needs to be a tremendous reduction in corruption and other ills in those societies. The last administration started a very aggressive effort to work on that. It was called the Alliance for Prosperity. When Joe Biden was vice president, he had this portfolio. He called the presidents of those countries every single month and asked them to report to him on what it is that they were doing with the money that the United States was giving them and with the commitments that they had made to improve the systems in their countries. It actually has had some results. But there's so much more to do. And unfortunately, this administration has cut back on its requests for funding, and the Congress has not allocated the kind of funding that the United States has given, even recognizing that ultimately the work has to be done in these countries as well. But the United States has an important role to play in helping.
Indeed, in terms of funding and supporting politically to nip this problem in the bud, in a sense, in those countries.
That's right. And these are longer-term projects. This is not something that happens overnight. And so you need to have leadership and you need to have the case be made to elected leaders, to the public, to immigrant communities, that these are processes that are underway, but they will take years to accomplish.
So we need a multi-pronged approach. As we close, let's take a look at the refugee issue. At a time when we have a worldwide refugee crisis, whether from Syria and other places, we are seeing that the United States is taking in fewer refugees historically since World War II. Last year, the Trump administration lowered the refugee number to 45,000. And this year, we understand from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that the intake would be 30,000 for the United States. This has struck many people in this country as an extraordinarily low number for a country that could very well absorb many and which benefits from refugees in the long run who become very productive citizens. What's your take and what is behind, in your view, this drastic cut in the number of refugees to this country?
Well, it's one of the most acute examples of the very different point of view that this president takes toward immigration and how it is that he sees immigration. As we were saying earlier, he sees immigration as a national security threat. And so he describes refugees in particular as representing a danger to the United States. He equates the fact that people coming from Syria could be terrorists with the fact that Syria harbors terrorists. This is cognitive dissonance. I mean, there's no evidence for this. We have very strong refugee vetting procedures. We have very thorough refugee screening mechanisms. There is no evidence that the refugee flow and that resettling refugees brings with it terrorists to the United States, or that these are people that somehow or another do not integrate well into U.S. society. The evidence is entirely the opposite. But that's what we're now dealing with. And of course, the numbers are even more dramatic than you say, because although the ceiling was lowered last year to 45,000, only about 20,000 people will actually be coming to the United States this year as refugees, because the administration has not pushed the agencies. The refugee resettlement from overseas is a very complex process. This is a major humanitarian denial of opportunity and possibilities to some people who are really needy and in very, very dire circumstances, almost entirely women and children. But it's also, more broadly, a real abdication of leadership and moral voice for the United States that has been so important to the world and to our role in the world for decades. We're giving that up with these kinds of actions and these kinds of characterizations of refugees and refugee resettlement.
Doris Meissner is a former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. She's now a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. Doris Meissner, thank you so much for coming and sharing your fabulous insights with us.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced here in Washington. Our engineer was Cornelius Tenor, and joining me on the program was VOA immigration reporter Aline Barros. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.